So a few months ago, maybe only a month ago, I can't remember now the exact date, I was invited to Seoul, Korea, to give a presentation at the e-learning conference. Had never been to Korea before, had a wonderful visit, but the timing of their invite coincided with a personal project to write this paper and prepare this presentation that I ended up naming Rehumanize. So the notes for this presentation and work project is it's ongoing project, as all my projects are really, you can find on wikiversity.org. Just search for my name and search Rehumanize. It should land on there. And what I'm looking at here is the PDF version of the slides presented to the conference in Korea. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get a recording of the presentation because there was a translation made into Korean during the presentation. It would have been wonderful to get that. So anyway, moving on. What I started the presentation with was the first few minutes of the video from 1968 that's come to be called the mother of all demos, which was the presentation by Douglas Engelbart and his team, showing what amounts to be the first personal computer with video conferencing and collaborative text authoring and hyperlinking and a number of other features which are commonplace, the mouse, the screen, etc. So I just played that silently in the background while I prepared to make the presentation, launching into the first slide, which was to look at the byline of the conference, a curious title or curious byline, A Happy Encounter with New Technology. So it was e-learning Korea 2017, A Happy Encounter with New Technology. And anyone who's paying attention to the commentary about the internet and even some cultural outputs such as the TV series Black Mirror and a number of others, which I'll look at more closely here in this talk, knows that we are beginning to dwell on the less happy, if not unhappy, if not darker side of the new technology. And so I want to acknowledge that unhappiness that has been created by technology in this presentation, and then propose that we find our way back to a humanist perspective, to critical appreciation of technology, but more importantly, perhaps to ward off the technocratic tyrants or technocracy that have moved into the space. And then perhaps discover, at least theoretically, what technological happiness might be. So I dare say the Korean conference organizers didn't mean to have such a serious angle taken on their byline, but yeah, the timing of their invite and my attention was given towards humanism at the time. So I took the opportunity to make that connection. I introduced myself as I've worked in the tertiary education sector in Australia and New Zealand 15 years. I've tended to focus on the internet, socially networked media, and open education, and more complicatedly, networked learning as it relates to tertiary education and informal learning. And I posit that e-learning is a growth industry promoted to transfer wealth, and that was abundantly evident at the e-learning conference Korea, which was kind of like a hyper event, similar to many other events I've been to, where you have a pavilion of technology developers showcasing their wares in an exhibition format, and the conference is there to give some sort of deeper content around that, but I think primarily, at least, the conference is financed by that in e-learning industry that want to show and sell their wares. And then, therefore, the ideas that in the conference and ideas around e-learning with that premise of being financed, these ideas are mined for the occasional use within the narrow spectrum of the commercial viability. So there may be ideas such as humanism well beyond and outside its financial and economic viability. And then therefore they're ignored, but where ideas can be commodified and commercialized, they're then taken. And the Luddites of this time, the use the word Luddite. Typically, we use it disparagingly towards people who want to ignore or don't know much about technology. We call them Luddites, but don't have to look far to find that it was a conscientious political movement against another type of technology some time ago. And our Luddites today, they have something to say. It's just that they haven't been given an opportunity to be heard. So starting with the adage that's attributed to McLuhan, perhaps falsely attributed, but it's good enough. At first we shape our tools and thereafter they shape us. And this is from my perspective anyway, or my interpretation, a very technologically determined perspective. It's a sort of almost like a fatalism. At first, an acknowledgement that our tools are very influential to us, but also a fatalism that it ends at that. They shape us after that. So I want to ask is, when is that time of at first? And when is that time of thereafter? Or a more positive spin on that question is this the time that we are free to shape our tools? Or is it the time where we've lost our freedom to the tools? Or are we always in the time where we are free to shape our tools and react to that shaping? And I hope we are always free to react and shape those tools. Images you might be noticing there from an archive about Korea, and we're looking at Japanese warships coming into Korea to force Korea open for trade in the early 19th century. And the early 19th century is not the beginning, but it's modernism in its earnest. We're getting steam and industrialism and mass production. And I found a really excellent essay by Thomas Carlyle, authored in this time, called The Mechanical Age. And he's expressing some anxiety about this new age of modernism and industrialism and what it's creating in our thinking and our culture. And he says, so I pulled out a quick quote, that in the management of external things, we excel all other ages, while in whatever respects the pure moral nature and true dignity of soul and character, we are perhaps inferior to most civilized ages. That's a very strong statement, disparaging of the mechanical age. And of modernism, and it's basically describing a very mechanized thought. And so moving through that modernism into the early 20th century, launching into those horrific wars we call world wars and all the wars around them, related to them, we might say that we found ourselves in a technocracy or political and social arena, which is very controlled by the technologies we've created. In other words, we are now shaped by the tools we created, and perhaps even, perhaps definitely, the massive investment we put towards the wars, and then those industries needing to find their place in peacetime, and then their production coming into domestic use. And so then there's this essay by L.M. Jacobs, A Technological History of Modernity, another excellent essay in my opinion, and I've pulled out this little quote: if the Allies won the war simply because of their technological superiority, and then precisely because of that success, allowed their societies to become purely technocratic, ruled by the military-industrial complex, their victory would become a largely hollow one. So the common narrative is that the 20th century wars, particularly World War II, was to fight for human freedom against fascism. But perhaps technocracy is fascism. And then our victory over fascism and assuring human freedom is a hollow one, because then we allowed those fascistic technologies to rule us anyway. From industrialism through modernity, resulting in technocracy, are we now in a, or have we now been in a dehumanized state? You might say that modernity is a mechanized people, allowing themselves to believe that their ends justify their means. Today, in the last maybe 20 years, we've talked about a transhumanized state where technology and what it means to be human, or the human physical state, morph together, and we become transhuman. And then and for me, this evokes the book Brave New World, where we embrace that transhuman state for its pleasure and its convenience in a post-human state. So Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, another quote just from that: in our quest to live as gods, we'll be leaving much of our humanity behind. Sorry, it's not from the book, Alfred MacLay's The Burden of Humanities, but it's relevant to the story of Brave New World, where from our perspective in, let's say, the here and now, looking into this future world of the Brave New World, it's clearly oppressive and miserable. But from their perspective, the people who live in this world most enjoy it and see no problem with it, all except for one, and those who live outside of that world on the reserves. More recently, Adam Curtis has been writing a lot about this technology and technocratic society that we're in. He produced All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, which is quite a nice documentary made in 2011, looking at the ideology that has inspired and produced the technologies, particularly the computing technologies, and then putting the idea forward that technology has distorted the meaning of humanity to fit the ideology, perhaps. Before that documentary, Adam Curtis made the doco The Trap, which looks at the ideology of, let's say, economic rationalism that fed into the ideology of computing and the internet. And because I'm looking at or citing films in this presentation, I couldn't resist citing my favorite director, Werner Herzog, as it was fairly recently that he produced and published, lo and behold, a documentary looking at the internet. And it seemed to me that what's typical of Werner Herzog, it's summarized down to he was trying to find the humans behind the internet and in the internet. And I had the feeling that he left the project feeling like he didn't find them, or that their humanity had been lost. And I think it was a final scene. He had this picture of maybe Thai monks all on their phones, and said, "Have the monks stopped meditating? They all seem to be tweeting." And it's a very humorous but profound documentary. If you haven't seen it, I thoroughly recommend it. And most of us now aware of Charlie Brooker's production, the Black Mirror TV series. And that's a depiction of a terribly dehumanized state of the not too far future, perhaps, of a both technocratic and transhuman existence. And each episode is nightmarish in different ways. And if I go back, that TV series Black Mirror brings into popular consciousness a number of anxieties that have been held for at least 20 years, longer even, if we look at those references I have to industrialism. But it brings into popular thought those anxieties so that more of us are able to consider them. And this is where, again, my hope for a rehumanized state. But we've looked at some ideas of what the ideological basis is for the technology. And then we can speculate that if you believe that adage of at first we shape our tools and thereafter they shape us, we might be in a powerless state where we're simply subjected to the technological will of that ideology, and we're left to be shaped by it, and then we adopt that ideology in a brave new world sense, where we might even be happy and unaware of it on the whole. But I think there is a rising number of people who are becoming more conscious and articulate on this, and are not happy with that deterministic outlook, and are seeing evidence of the unhappy side of this technology, and even the darker side. And perhaps many of us are finding ourselves extremely powerless in this, and that's something to observe. And I sort of say I try to say in a more hopeful sense that we're at an impasse where we feel powerless. We don't know what to do, and nor do the authors of the technology know what to do. They surely share some of our anxieties, but we're all a little bit lost of what to do about this. And so I simply say that we face this impasse with hope. And to explain what that means, I refer to Ivan Illich, as always, in his book, Deschooling Society. I think it's chapter 6 or 7, The Rebirth of Epimethean Man. And he has a beautiful interpretation, in my opinion, of the Greek myth or tragedy of Prometheus, his brother Epimetheus, and their shared interest, or Epimetheus' interest, in the famous Pandora and Pandora's box. And I'll just quote Illich: to understand what this means, we must rediscover the distinction between hope and expectation. Hope, in its strong sense, means trusting faith in the goodness of nature, perhaps human nature, while expectation, as I will use it here, means reliance on results which are planned and controlled by man. A description of mechanized technocratic thinking. Hope centers desire on a person from whom we await a gift. Expectation looks forward to satisfaction from a predictable process, which will produce what we have the right to claim. The Promethean ethos has now eclipsed hope. I should have familiarized just listeners to the story of Prometheus and Epimetheus and Pandora. But Prometheus is generally accepted as a god-like figure who stole fire from the gods to give it to man, to give it to people. So stole a technology, a magical technology, because it was held by the gods, and made it accessible and usable for people. And the gods were furious of this theft, and then committed Prometheus to a eternity of suffering, and perhaps men or people, humanity as well. Prometheus, as the word implies, has the benefit of foresight, of planning, of developing an expectation for things. Now, Epimetheus has the opposite attributes. He has the benefit, like to say, of hindsight, of seeing it for what it was and has become. And his story is that he was attracted to Pandora. His brother Prometheus, having foresight, warned him not to be involved with Pandora. And Pandora was the giver of everything on Earth, I suppose, the creator. Not the creator, but a creator. And she held what we call the Pandora's box, or the vessel that contains everything. And she opened that box and released all of the evils of the world. I'm not sure if, I hope I'm more or less telling this story accurately or usefully. But she released all the evils of the world. But of the last thing that to escape, she retained, and it is hope. She might say the vessel is humanity. So from humanity out into the world, all manner of evils can be produced. But contained in all of us is still hope. And the point of the story from Illich's point of view is that Epimetheus saw this, saw the horror of it all, saw that hope was retained, and married Pandora for it. He loved and married her for it. So he loves humanity and trusts humanity and values that one element of hope that will override all those other elements released. My own efforts on those more hopeful aspects is to try and produce what I've called an ethical framework for ubiquitous learning. So this is returning to my focus and employment area is in tertiary education, where I look at informal learning and how people just generally learn, especially in this time of internet. And I wanted to reclaim the word ubiquitous learning as it had been appropriated by mobile computing and those who would sell apps and phones and always on technology. I wanted to reclaim ubiquitous learning away from that technologically determined space and to reposition it into a state of human being that is always learning everywhere. Everywhere and everything we do is learning about something. And I wanted to posit perhaps an ethical framework. I don't think that's a very good title for it, but it's a framework for understanding that type of learning, that informal learning, and to come up with a framework that would help us consider it and discuss it and understand it. And to that, I used a somewhat unrelated field of permaculture. But the permaculture design principles is a model where they have what I just articulated might be said as the ethic that learning happens everywhere and everything. It's a state of being human, and so it's somehow more be more articulate on that. And around those, we develop a range of principles that allow that ethic to move forward or to exist and to have action around it. And from those principles, we design any number of methods. But we look at the outcomes of those methods and return them back to and hold them accountable to the principles. That's basically the model for the permaculture design principles. And that model has helped permaculture as a practice for self-sufficient, sustainable subsistence living to scale right across the world. But you won't generally find it in formal education, but it's a very popular and very interesting method of producing food and running economies around food and shelter for that matter. Another word that comes into relationship to hope is faith, and I don't mean to sound so religious, I'm not being religious necessarily, but I want to quote Paul Goodman, who wrote an essay in 1969, Can Technology Be Humane? And the essence of that essay, I think, is in this quote. And yet there is a powerful surge of localism, populism, and community action, as if people were determined to be free, even if it makes no sense. A mighty empire is stood off by a band of peasants, and neither can win. It means that neither principle is historically adequate, nor the principle of technocracy, nor the principle of hope and faith and humanity. But in Paul Goodman's opinion, in my opinion, these dilemmas and impasses show that we are on the eve of a transformation of conscience. So that's what I'm wondering, is what we've called rehumanizing. I'm wondering if we're at a point where we're becoming aware of the unhappy and darker aspects of this technology and giving more attention now to a range of ways of using the technology, of understanding it. And that might be, as Paul Goodman wrote in 69, be enough to transform our conscience toward it. So a few more links relevant to this presentation. If you haven't, you can always go back and watch Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. I think it is available on YouTube. There's a very good essay, again from the 60s, I think. Oh, no, sorry, it was from the 80s. I can't remember the name of the author, I'm sorry, but the link here, Why I'm Not Going to Buy a Computer. It's a conservative's point of view about the impact that the computer has on his profession and love of writing. Humanist Technology Criticism is another link there. And because it's been so long ago, I can't remember what that links to. How can we change the way technologies are innovated? Another interesting essay. The Manifesto of the Free University International by Joseph Beuys in the 1972 carries forward a number of usable principles, in my opinion. Sense-making, the power of humanities in the age of algorithm, another pertinent essay. So I hope you can find your way to either the Wikiversity page, my blog post, or these slides in PDF form, and click those links and have a look, because I rate those as influential to my thinking here. And if it's been useful, you might want to go further and see if you can do better at articulating these ideas. Thanks for listening.